so you've heard enough from me now. Without further ado, I'll hand you over to Tim, who has organised this whole weekend. So it's Tim who's been responsible for writing all the papers, putting the speakers together, putting together this wonderful programme. So over to you, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Apparently it's a record turnout, so clearly there's a lot of interest in the hard problem of consciousness, which is exactly as it should be. So thank you very much, and thank you to Fawzia for offering to host the weekend. She'll be in charge of the proceedings, so if there is any bad behaviour, you'll have Fawzia to answer to. I hope you like the picture that I found for this. I stole it off the internet, as you do these days. It's not exactly how I would draw consciousness, I have to admit, but it does raise an interesting question of how you would draw consciousness. What is the correct way to represent consciousness on a diagram? And I think if we knew the answer to that, then maybe we wouldn't have the hard problem in the first place. Just one for you to ponder on there. Right, my job for the next, what have we got, 20 minutes or so, is to introduce the topic. I will assume zero knowledge, which tends to serve me well in most of my interactions with people, but I know that's not the case today, and I know a lot of you will be very familiar with the hard problem and the various aspects of it, but nevertheless, I'll assume you don't know anything, and I'll try and take a back-to-basics approach and, if possible, get to the kind of the heart of the problem. So, why the hard problem? It was a term that was invented by this chap, David Chalmers. He's an Australian philosopher. He did his undergraduate degree in maths, which all the best people do, apparently. And he came to Oxford in 1987, not quite sure what to do, fell out of love with maths, found philosophy, which again, all the best people do. And what he did, he looked at the philosophy of mind, and rather than getting into trying to solve anything, he tried to analyse the field. So he started to catalogue all the different positions that people held, and he produced a wonderful sort of hierarchical structure of all the various positions. But he also started to look at the questions that people asked, and the problems that they tried to solve. And he distinguished two distinct types. There were the easy problems, what he called the easy problems. And these were things to do with how the brain functions, how we respond to stimuli, how we speak, reporting on our mental states, how we control our body's behaviour. In fact, anything to do with the functioning of the body, where you might have an input of one kind in terms of information, sensory input, and you have outputs of other kinds in terms of movement, speech, and so on. He distinguished that from the hard problem, which is understanding how and why such functioning is accompanied by what you might call the subjective phenomenal experience of consciousness, or conscious experience. And he wasn't saying that these easy problems are easy. In fact, they're actually quite difficult, but they're an order of magnitude different from the hard problem. You can at least, with the easy problems, see how you might go about solving them. You can at least imagine what the solution might look like, what form it might take. But the hard problem, there's no agreement to even that. Nobody can agree, or the main philosophers in the field can't agree on what a solution to the hard problem might actually look like, or even whether there's a solution at all. Now, I describe in the programme, this thing, if you haven't got it, I describe the hard problem as probably the most important problem in the philosophy of mind. I'd actually go further than that. I actually think it's the most exciting problem in philosophy overall. Now, why do I say that? Obviously, it's a subjective opinion, but I do have my reasons. The main one is that it's not just a philosophical problem, it's a scientific problem. And you can see that there are many people who would call themselves scientists, neuroscientists, some physicists as well, that would say that they are working to try and solve the hard problem, as there are philosophers. Which means there's a real opportunity here for philosophers to actually make a major contribution to science and our understanding of the natural world. And given the grief that philosophy tends to get from scientists, wouldn't it be wonderful if this problem was actually solved by a philosopher rather than by a scientist? You know, I think it would help maybe to put philosophy, at least in one way, back on the map as far as scientists were concerned. But also, it's not just an opportunity for the academics. I believe it's, as a problem, it's easy to understand. The solutions that people come up with are very difficult, and I get that. Philosophers can make these this topic very difficult. But nevertheless, the basic questions of how does the brain create consciousness, why is consciousness created out of matter, these are relatively easy to understand. And no one knows the answer. And this was one of the key things I was shocked with when I actually took the online course in the philosophy of mind that Marion wrote, didn't you? About 10 years ago, I think it was. Great course. I think it's still going, isn't it? If anybody hasn't done it, I would certainly recommend they do. And what you find is that people are disagreeing about the answer. Okay, we're talking about the mind-body problem and the philosophy of mind overall, but people are still disagreeing with the answer today as much as they did 100 years ago. And you'd think that if philosophers have been working on this problem for a century or maybe centuries, you'd think they'd make progress. You'd think they'd be closing in on what the solution is. But I don't believe that's the case. Yes, the arguments people are having today are different to the arguments of 100 years ago, no doubt. But there's still, for everybody that would say they're closing in on the solution, you've got as many people saying that, well, no, you're a million miles away from it. And so the disagreements that are going on in the philosophy of mind overall are still there. Now, that's not the case generally in science. Because, of course, you might say, well, yes, it's a philosophical problem, so obviously we're going to disagree, and there's never going to be an agreement that's the way that philosophy works. But it's not how science tends to work. You do tend to find the answer eventually. Science is a project of progress, and generally it's about building up a body of knowledge, standing on the shoulders of giants, and so on. So given that this is a scientific problem as well as a philosophical one, I would suggest that maybe the answer is actually out there somewhere. And because it's accessible to everyone, it's not just academics that have a chance of finding it. I think everyone in this room has the same chance as anyone else. There's something missing in our understanding of the problem, some big mistake perhaps that everybody is making. We don't know what that is. And there's as much chance, I'm suggesting, that anyone in this room could find that as any of the academics. Now, you might ask, well, hang on, where does this hard problem then fit into the overall mind-body problem? So what I'm going to try and do here is paint a sort of a conceptual map of how one fits into the other. So I warned Marianne that if I do make a mistake, she's to correct me in the break, not while I'm going. But you can check with her later to see if I do get this right. Okay, the mind-body problem, as you know, it's about how we relate these two concepts, mind or spirit, you might say, on the one hand, against body or matter on the other. And I've chosen a picture there that betrays the dualist intuition that we all tend to have, that the mind is somehow sitting in some bubble, separate to our bodies. But generally, we don't think in those sort of terms anymore. As I said at the beginning, it's hard to know exactly how you meant to draw consciousness, so I have tended to use that. But today we don't tend to talk about spirit because we're all physicalists these days, aren't we? We all believe that consciousness comes from physical matter in one way or the other. Okay, I can see a few heads in there. Which just shows why, it's a hard problem that really nobody can agree with the answer. But generally, we tend to talk less about spirit. We also talk less about body. We tend to talk about physical matter, opening the possibility that maybe objects like an artificially intelligent computer might possess consciousness, perhaps. So we're more likely to say mind and matter. And it's less about how the mind fits into matter as it is about how our concepts of mind fit with our concepts matter and the physical world. So we tend to talk about brain states, mental states. We might talk about physical events and mental events. When we talk about mental states, you might talk about propositional attitudes, such as beliefs, likes, desires, anything that you would add the word that followed by a proposition. So I believe that so-and-so is the case. I like that so-and-so is the case. I desire a certain situation to arise. And these are states that you could imagine programming into a computer or into a robot. So for example, there's a microphone here, and this, it could be fed into this computer. I don't think it is, but if it was, the computer would then, in its memory, have information that represents the belief that there is sound, and it's sound of a certain pitch, and so on. So we can imagine, in regard to propositional attitude, programming that into some kind of computer. Now, qualitative states is a little harder. These are experiences, experiential states. So, sight, sound, beliefs. So, sight, sound, feelings. Things that it is like to be, or it is like to have those states. Conscious experiences. And we don't know how to program that into a computer. Clearly there's some sort of link. The computer has detected the sound. But we don't imagine the computer is actually experiencing the sound, the qualitative aspect of sound. It might have a camera, but we don't imagine the computer can actually see the image that it's captured in its memory. There's something interesting going on within the qualitative state, which is a little harder to understand, and a little harder, as I said, to program onto any computer. So already we can see this sort of distinction between the easy and the hard. The sort of easy problems you might ask is how the sensory inputs result in those beliefs I was just talking about, beliefs about sound, about what exists in front of me, in front of the camera. And we can talk about how were they achieved in the brain. We can talk about how the brain converts those beliefs into behaviour and speech. We have a whole conversation about how a human being does all of this, and it's essentially the same conversation you might be having in regard to a computer or a robot. Down the bottom, this is where the harder questions come in. How do those sensory inputs then result in sights, sounds, and feelings? That's so much harder to understand. And you've also got interesting questions around how do those two types of states relate to each other? Is it a causal link? Does a conscious state in some way cause a belief to arise? Does it cause our behaviour? Or is it epiphenomenal? And there are lots of people that believe that consciousness is actually epiphenomenal, which kind of raises the question, well, why is it there then? You know, it's a function as a human being. We only need these mental states at the top. Why do we need any of the ones at the bottom? Why do we need these qualitative states? And why does the body create them if they don't actually have a role? We can also ask then, if we're a machine, just like the robot is a machine, and I know many people might not like that word, but we're a physical, biological machine, I think most scientists would say. So we're in essence the same as that computer. It's made of physical matter. I'm processing information up here. Computer's processing information there. Why have I got consciousness but not the computer? Or has the computer consciousness? We don't really know. Now, David Chalmers wrapped up these harder questions and said, yeah, that's what we call the hard problem. So there isn't just a single question, sorry. There isn't just a single question, but he put that in that bubble called the hard problem. And I think while that how there is certainly very, very hard in his way of speaking, I think it's the why that for Chalmers really does it. So he put it this way. Why is it that when our cognitive systems process visual or auditory information, we have visual or auditory experience? The quality of deep blue or the sensation of middle C. How can we explain why there is something it is like to entertain a mental image or to experience an emotion? It's widely agreed that the experience arises from a physical basis. So just to emphasise, he's coming at this from the point of view of physicalism. And I know we don't all agree that, but that's the kind of the underlying premise of the heart problem. But we have no good explanation, he says, of why and how it so arises. And these are the words that I like. Why should physical processes give rise to an inner life at all? A rich inner life at all? It seems objectively unreasonable that it should, and yet it does. And he went on to ask this question. Why are we not zombies? You know, if we don't need this consciousness stuff in order to function, if our bodies would function just on the basis of the program that's in our DNA and according to the laws of physics, then why do we need consciousness at all? In fact, you know, why aren't human beings walking around doing the things they do, saying the things they say, you know, saying they're in pain if you pinch them, but actually they're only saying it because they're programmed to say it, but actually having no conscious experience at all? Now, of course, that picture is not what David Chalmers meant when he talked about philosophical zombies. He talked about these people. And he suggested that the sort of zombie he's talking about would be indistinguishable from the real thing, from someone who had consciousness. They would act exactly the same. And he suggested that such creatures are entirely conceivable, given everything we know about physics and the physical world. And if they're conceivable, they're possible. So if they're possible, why are we not zombies? What is it then that gives us that conscious experience? And the more that Chalmers concentrated on the problem, the more he came to decide that this thing we call consciousness, this thing, the way we conceive of it, it simply doesn't fit with the physical world as we conceive that to be. And he put it like this. Consciousness fits uneasily into our conception of the natural world. On the most common conception of nature, the natural world is the physical world. But on the most common conception of consciousness, it is not easy to see how it could be part of the physical world. So it seems that to find a place for consciousness within the natural order, we must either revise our conception of consciousness or revise our conception of nature. Now, I like this quote because it kind of sets the challenge for us over the next 2 days, for which we've found 7 speakers who will be attacking this problem in various ways. And ideally, they will somehow figure out how consciousness fits into the physical world, answer all of David Chalmers' questions, and thereby solve the whole problem. So they've all assured me that they have an answer. So I'm very much looking forward to it. No, I'm joking. It's a hard problem, we know that. If we solve it, that would be great. If we shed some light on it, give our own perspective, that would be great too. And that's really what we're trying to do. I've designed this so that on today, for the rest of the afternoon, you'll see 5 different positions, ranging from the more physicalist, Mike Arnotoff, to perhaps the more dualist, and I say more dualist, Alan Bailey. Mike will say why the problem is hard but not that hard. And obviously we'll talk about the different perspectives one can have. I'll probably get the words wrong here, but different perspectives on nature in terms of Ponta and Qualia. In the middle we have the scientific perspective coming from Cannon. I can't see him, but he's somewhere around. Oh, there you are, Anna. Who will talk about quantum mechanics, neuroscience, and what that might tell us about consciousness. Paul Griffiths will bring an artificial intelligence view into this. But what we can actually learn from the possibility that a human being, that we could actually build an artificial human being, that you couldn't tell the difference, you know, if we could do that, what would that mean? And Bob is going to try and bring us back to philosophy, and to the philosophy of mind, and try and make sense of all of this. So good luck with that, Bob. On Sunday, what I've done on Sunday is try and save the 2 most extreme talks to the end, so we can have more fun. In a set. So Jonathan will bring the attitude of problem, what problem? You know, consciousness is a marvellous thing, no doubt, but is it really a mystery? And I will make the case for why, yes, it is a problem, and the problem lies in our understanding of the physical world. And in fact, consciousness isn't something that is created by the brain, that already exists within the matter of which we're made. As I said, these are the extreme points of view. I don't expect you to believe either one of them, but it would be very interesting to find out in the bar which one of these you're leaning towards to start with and whether any of that changes, but we'll find out at the end of the session. So, not to forget, the panel discussion is 11:30 tomorrow morning. We'll get all seven speakers up on the stage and fire all your questions at them. And I think that's about it. So, without further ado, and I'm on time, I can't believe that. Can I hand it over to Mike Ondertoff, who is not only an excellent philosopher, he's an excellent webmaster. And he looks after our website, which, without which the Philosophical Society would simply not function.